Well, greetings and welcome to The Dividing Line. We are at ReformCon 2022. I will confess that I really didn't know what to expect. I did not know how many people were going to be here or from where or anything like that at all. And it's a really nice venue, and so far we've been having a lot of fun. Hopefully we'll be having some, in fact, we have a guest coming right now, in fact, to join us. But I've already spoken this morning, which means everyone has gotten their nap and are rested up now that I'm out of the way. And but we have some other folks that haven't spoken yet. And come on in, brother. We're doing it. We're doing things live here. And one of the folks that will be speaking, I think, primarily tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Greetings and welcome. And let's turn the. No, this camera here.
Get that camera.
This camera here.
There
you go.
More towards Joe.
Should be familiar to the audience of The Dividing Line, except you're normally sitting on a flat panel screen. And in fact, I don't think we've had you on from England yet. You haven't been over there all that long.
No, just a couple of months, actually.
Yeah. I mean, that is home.
It is home, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, honestly, where would you rather be, England or Canada?
Well, let's just say I'm glad at this stage in my life with my family to be back in England.
Okay,
yeah,
all right.
I'm glad to be back in England.
With your World Economic Forum Prime Minister?
It's not the whole cabinet, at least.
And your digital currency. Yeah. And, it's all. Anyway, we won't go into the depressing things right now, even though one of the funniest things I saw was a book that has yet to come out about the rise to power of Liz Truss.
Mm-hmm.
And the authors are like getting ready to jump off a bridge or something like that, because that didn't really pan out
too well.
No, even though she's got quite the nice pension.
Yeah.
What is it, 140?
I think it's something, somewhere in the region of if you've been prime minister.
You get this all. I think it's about 110, maybe 107.
That's not bad for 44
years.
Especially because she's not that old.
I think there is a question mark over whether she's going to accept it, being the shortest serving prime minister.
Yes.
I think she has a legal right to it.
Well, she probably does. She probably does. So, and I'm very thankful that you were able to join us after your period of mourning for the Queen.
Uh-huh.
I actually, when I heard about it, I had been thinking for a long, long time that I thought she was the most classy world leader around. There was a level of stability there, when you think of 70 years is
it's a long time.
Fair amount of time. And the king, I could ask you lots of interesting questions about theologically.
Mm-hmm.
And just real quickly, I heard, confirm for me whether it's true or not, bishops in the Church of England, the new prime minister has a role in actually picking them with the king. Is that true?
The most senior bishops, yeah.
Okay.
Like the Archbishop of Canterbury, the prime minister does have a role.
And the prime minister is a Hindu.
That is now correct. Yes. In fact, I think he was just. I think I just saw that he hosted some sort of Diwali celebration at Downing Street.
Yes, he was lighting candles outside, which. All this raises some interesting questions, because we're talking about Christian nationalism in the United States, but England has the church baked in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But looking at the church in England and what has happened with it, is there something to learn about the necessity of regeneration? When we're talking about, when we talk about the kingdom of Christ and an application in culture, a lot of what my background was is you push that away because every time it's been tried in the past, it ended up in nominalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you avoid that?
I'm not sure there is a way to entirely avoid the possibility of nominalism. I mean, we've seen it in even in new church movements, mm-hmm. Amongst the independents. I mean, if you look at some of the most apostate churches today, Methodism, Presbyterianism, where there would have been an emphasis on mm-hmm. regeneration
and holiness
and holiness mm-hmm. and holiness movements, yeah. and yet they've slumped into formalism, nominalism, and then eventually, you know, apostasy. I mean, you've hit on some really interesting things, and actually, even as you were kind of reading them back to me, the recent history, a few things were occurring. One of the interesting things about the Queen's passing, the timing of it this year, she designed her own funeral.
Yes, years and years ago. Yeah, if I recall. Yeah, like 20 years ago.
And if you actually, there were actually two services. One was at in London, of course, at the Abbey, mm-hmm. and then the other was at Windsor Castle. Mm-hmm. And both were actually quite powerful. I found the second one perhaps a little bit even more powerful than the first one. And 4 billion people.
Yes.
Nearly 4 billion people were watched in whole or in part that funeral. And the scripture readings
were incredible.
And it was incredible. It was like watching a gospel message. So, yes. And that kind of spoke to the issue you mentioned of with respect to Elizabeth, that there was a kind of soft power. We talk about soft power. Mm-hmm. She had very little formal power.
Right.
You know, when people sort of say, well, why didn't the Queen put a stop to this, and the Queen could have put a stop to that? And it's like, well, monarchy's changed mm-hmm. over the centuries, and so the power that she had was soft power, and if she had turned away some of these bills from Parliament, I mean, it would have immediately created a constitutional crisis, mm-hmm. and a question of, you know, what does politics look like? Mm-hmm. Essentially, a revolutionary political action would have been to say, I'm not signing that bill into law. And it would have created, now, some might argue, maybe she should have created a constitutional crisis, mm-hmm. perhaps. But the point is that her influence was soft power. And when she died, and I actually was much more affected by it than I thought I would be. Mm-hmm. I mean, she is, you know, what people say, you know, that when you referred to the Queen, there was only one person that people had in mind.
Yep.
Even though there's lots of queens in Europe, it was the Queen,
right.
Elizabeth, because she projected this incredible sense of stability. She was, the, in many respects, the last touchstone of old Christendom. Mm-hmm. She was the last referent for people to that from that older Christian era. Mm-hmm. And there was an interesting article in The Telegraph, a major British broadsheet, a couple of days later that I was interested in, and the headline of it was, Britain is yearning for traditional Christianity.
Mm.
And it was this incredible moment where very few people are relatively speaking now, the Church of England's fallen below a million
yes.
people,
yes.
are in church on a Sunday morning in an Anglican church listening to the gospel, and yet 4 billion people tuned into the gospel mm-hmm. at the end of the Queen's life. The point being, the mainline churches have thought that if we water down the gospel, if we have a more politically correct woke version that we think is going to be less offensive, it's going to draw people, it's going to be more attractive, it's going to be more relevant. And actually the opposite is true, and even the Daily Telegraph realized that. Mm-hmm. This is what people think Christianity should be mm-hmm. there at the Queen's funeral. So it was hard on from that perspective. It was also difficult from the other point you raised, which is who's following her. And into the role. Now, you know, there had been talk previously about, well, when Elizabeth dies, there's going to be a constitutional crisis, and people are going to be calling for the end to the establishment in England and so on. And Charles is going to be defender of the faith, plural, and everything. That didn't really happen. And in fact, he said that he made quite clear that he was committed to his mother's faith. And that he was going to defend the faith and take his role seriously as an Anglican. How seriously one can take that, given his track record, that's a problem. And I think the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. I also think it was significant that Liz Truss was the last Prime Minister that Queen Elizabeth invited to form a government. And basically, within a few weeks, there's been a coup, because she wants a small state. She's a nominal Christian, but she wants a small state. She wants to cut taxes. She wants to basically have a war on woke. And
the market said no.
Yeah. At least the markets, influenced by the articles from the elites, from the banks, all of the opposition that she immediately... Now, one could argue, and it has been argued, well, if she'd have delivered these punches slowly, and the presentation had been better for a budget, and, you know, Kwasi Kwarteng had done it slightly differently, maybe there's some merit to that, that it could have been handled differently and therefore gone over better. But I was speaking to one of our fellows, Graham Leach, who's a remarkable Christian economist in the UK, thought it was both the best budget and the best cabinet since the era of Margaret Thatcher.
Mm.
But that's not what the elites Mm-mm. want. Mm-mm. They don't want the state rolled back. They don't want the state largesse and the handouts. And they don't, actually, I would argue, not sure they even want incredible growth and productivity right. to release the small businessman and the ordinary working person and the self-employed into prosperity. And so within a few weeks, you have a coup giving us the shortest serving prime minister in British history, and then the coronation, really, of our new prime minister, Rishi Sunak, who happens to be Hindu. Now,
And wealthier than the king.
And wealthier than the king. Yeah, he married a billionaire. I think she's a billionaire. And I think he also has a green card in the US, so, which is interesting. Now, it's been interesting to see what some of the Christian commentators have said, because they've sort of said, well, better a competent Hindu mm-hmm. than an incompetent nominal Christian.
Right.
And on the surface, that sounds plausible. But then the next minute, you know, you've got Diwali celebrations happening at Downing Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that, and in fact, I'm in the process of writing a short article on this, is that I think that Rishi Sunak is a reasonably competent politician. And he's actually got some solid people in his cabinet, including people like Kemi Vonnebeck, who I'm not sure I've got her name quite right there, but that's close. Kemi, who's a devout Christian, an evangelical. And the only reason that, in a certain sense, Rishi's perspectives don't represent a direct, his religious perspectives don't currently represent a direct threat to British politics, is because he's been radically watered down by Christianity.
Mm.
And that's the point. He is operating within a Christian constitutional arrangement. And I'd have to sit down with the man to discover what he really believed about Hinduism and so forth, but presumably he's not going to try and institute the caste system in the UK, and we're not going to be reintroducing the burning of widows on the funeral pyres of their
right,
husbands.
Right.
So he's got a Christianized Western version mm-hmm. of Hinduism mm-hmm. that allows him, actually, and people, a lot of Christian commentators fail to appreciate that. They say, oh, what a triumph for religious pluralism, and, you know, he's a Christianized... He's in the Conservative Party. He's a Christianized Hindu who is now operating within that framework. And the actual root religious motives of the faith he professes can't take the reins. And you know, I'm not even sure that he would how committed he would. How much is he a nominal Hindu
mm-hmm.
Is difficult to answer. But I do think there's been something of a coronation there of a prime minister who wasn't picked by the Conservative Party faithful, but he was the elite's choice, and the first prime minister, therefore, that King Charles III invites to form a government is a Hindu.
Right.
Whereas the last one that Elizabeth II invited to form a government was a nominally Christian, conservative. So it's a very interesting time in the UK, but there is some growing pushback against wokery. There's been a closing of the gender clinic.
Yes.
There's Mermaids, which is a radical trans organisation in the UK, is now under investigation. You've got several in the current cabinet who are basically being tasked with pushing back against some of this woke agenda. We've had a piece of legislation that's enforcing freedom of speech in the college campuses because it was disappearing. So there are a few small positive signs,
mm-hmm.
but they are few and far between. And what people seem to want is bread and circuses.
Yeah. And the same situations you all are facing in Canada remain as far as the restrictive legislation, and you don't see much in the way of bright lights. Well,
it's
Alberta,
getting worse.
Well, but the
in Alberta,
in Alberta, you did have at least
the new premier there.
Yeah,
is pushing back a little bit.
So the
that's the most conservative province in Canada.
And the premier there would be the equivalent of a governor of a state.
Correct. Right? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, how much authority does she really have over against some decree from Trudeau?
Well, there is actually the Wild Rose Party in Alberta is pushing for either full separation or at least a much greater degree of independence for Alberta. Alberta is the one province that has talked about this for a long time, and there are certain constitutional potentialities in Alberta that would allow them to separate. How much traction Wild Rose really has is difficult to say, but she is certainly, or the new premier is certainly aware that there are a lot of people in Alberta who are sick to the back teeth of the federal government.
Mm.
And historically that's often been true in that part of the country. And so she's pushing back a bit. So in Canada, you've got certain powers are devolved to the provinces, including things like education and health, and a certain amount of taxation too. So the powers, actually, interestingly, of a provincial parliament in Canada are actually probably even greater than a regional governor in a state governor in the USA. But they're never used, they're very rarely ever used, mainly because much of the Canadian provinces are on the take from the federal government.
Right, right.
And so it's always about the taps being turned off if there's any kind of pushback. So that's part of the issue. But in terms of the broader Canadian landscape over the last 6 months, 12 months, things from a legislative point of view just keep getting worse. So we've now got Bill C-11, which is now in its final readings in the Senate, which is basically a bill, to put it bluntly, and if people want to check my Twitter feed, they can see an article from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms on this bill, the Bill C-11. It's going to give basically control of internet content to the federal government. Videos, podcasts. It basically hands the key levers of authority and power to the federal government to essentially start controlling the internet in Canada.
Mm.
It's a highly dangerous bill, Bill C-11. And then you've got the expansion of what they call MAID coming up now in March next year in Canada, which is medical assistance in dying. So again, when this starts, you're told, well, it's just going to be for people who several doctors have said they're terminally ill and they're almost about to die, and we're just going to give them dignity. Well, lo and behold, it's been expanding and expanding and expanding. Mm. And now Canada is facing, in the new year, children and depressed people being legally euthanized.
Mm-hmm.
They call them mature minors, so children who are deemed mature enough to make the decision, and people who are depressed will have assisted suicide made available to them. And to top it all off, I just had a pastor contact me from Canada. I was in Canada last week speaking. And a pastor of a large church in Ontario contacted me. He said, "Joe, I've just had a situation this week." He said the police came to the church, and they are threatening me with being charged with criminal harassment because we are exercising church discipline. A member of the church received a letter from the elders about church discipline, and he's being threatened with charges of criminal harassment for church discipline in the life of the local church.
Mm.
These are some of the things that are actually are going on just north of the border,
mm-hmm.
With no sign of letting up at the moment.
So, with all that said, obviously the subject of Christian nationalism in the UK has a different, obviously a bit different background. The state church situation there mm-hmm. makes... correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is in the Mission of God, there was a section, and I think Rush Dooney was quoted a number of times in regards to the nature of what would have to happen as far as a move of God mm-hmm. to bring about true conversion so as to any type of quote-unquote Christian culture would have to be Christian in reality, not merely in name.
Yes.
And I'm hearing a lot of people pushing back because, again, as I said, from my tradition, the idea is we've already tried this, and it fails every single time.
Mm-hmm.
So what has to be different? I mean, you know, you look at a Charles, you look at his life, you look at Diana, you look at marriage, you look at his view of sexuality and everything else, and you just go, ouch. That's not what we'd be facing doing discipline.
Yeah.
Okay. In that situation, and of course you can't when he's the head of the church. But there's so much discussion of it now in the context of, well, what's your other option?
Because mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. we're seeing now what secular globalism, mm-hmm. in essence, is.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, you simply have political anarchy.
Yes.
There has to be some guiding principle, and yet to have obedience to God's law that is something other than formalistic, that actually flows from the heart,
mm-hmm.
there has to be a large number of actual Christians in
That's
a
right.
society.
Yeah.
Isn't that required, shall we say, before you can even be speaking? And so what are we talking about when we talk about Christian nationalism? Are we simply saying to our society, you need to have objective standards that can be passed from one generation to the next, mm-hmm. and secularism cannot provide you with anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, Christ or chaos.
Yeah.
Is that all we're doing until there is this major move of the Spirit of God
that
changes hearts and minds? Because right now I look around the hearts and minds and my heart breaks because mm-hmm. there is a love of death, there is a love of self-destruction, there's a hatred of God's law and a hatred of God's way that is all around us. Doesn't that have to change?
Yeah, I see where I see your thought process in this. It's an interesting question because part of the situation we're in now is uncharted territory. I mean, mm-hmm. before we were pagan, and then we Christianized, and it was because people were becoming Christians, and because of the transformation, and it was gradual, it was steady, it was gradual change, and it took, of course, the Reformation and men like John Knox and John Calvin and the Puritan Revolution in England, and even the Glorious Revolution post 1688 to actually get us to the point where we could have something like the evangelical awakening in England.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you look at the history of it, you see both things going on. You see what we might call political struggles and squabbles about which states are going to be Catholic and which are going to be mm-hmm. Protestant, which were not primarily driven by regeneration of matters of the heart.
Right.
And then at the same time, without the, there would have been no lasting impact for some of those political changes if there hadn't been incredible fruit in evangelism and Christian mm-hmm. education and so on going on at the same time. So we are in this uncharted territory because we're at this de-Christianizing point. Secularization and secularism is failing all around us. It's collapsing. Multiculturalism is imploding. Radical progressivism is eating itself alive. And where does the culture actually go? Now, if we look at, say, the arrangement in England, and of course you have the slightly different arrangement in Scotland with Presbyterianism, King Charles III is the titular head of the Church of England, so it's a ceremonial role. The 39 Articles make clear that he has no authority inside the life of the Church. He hasn't the authority to teach the word or administer the sacraments. So there is a maintenance of a distinction between the role of Church and State within the constitutional arrangement in England. That, of course, has allowed the proliferation of freedom for all kinds of denominations historically. They didn't need to enforce Anglicanism. That was a struggle, you know that. Mm-hmm. You know the history of all of that, and you know that for a time even some of the Presbyterians would have liked a Presbyterian establishment in England. Mm-hmm. And so these different Protestant Reformed denominations, it took time to figure out what was going to be the ideal arrangement. Where we are, I think, now in a place like England is we're surrounded now with these cultural vestiges of Christianity.
Oh, yeah.
It's like the archaeology of Christianity. It's a kind of living archaeology. I mean, that's what you saw with the Queen's funeral.
Yeah,
you see this sort of living, that's probably the best term for it, a living archaeology of these cultural vestiges of the Christian faith. And people casting about now for some kind of sense of identity, some kind of sense of security, as all of the areas that we used to think of as sure and firm. I mean, a lot of the grief over the Queen is people grieving over the fact that there was a symbol of security, mm-hmm. of stability, and now she's gone. They don't actually fully appreciate that the only reason she was that symbol and that she had these virtues that people so appreciated was the depth of her Christian faith.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's what made her who she was, and you know, people sort of praising her sense of duty and loyalty and all this. Mm-hmm. Well, those virtues don't just drop down out of the sky. They're the product of a deep religious commitment, which speaks to your point, which is, where is the society going to go if you've not got virtue and duty and responsibility and justice and righteousness and so on, and these things being central to society, what's going to happen to it? I think that part of the key is, despite the Reformation and despite the English Revolution, we get to a point in the 1700s, so the 18th century, where things are a terrible mess. And there is a real, very real threat of a revolution breaking out in England like in France. And there was a genuine fear that that might happen.
Mm.
But then you had men like George Whitefield and John Wesley who were Anglicans, actually,
mm-hmm.
and who remained Anglicans, taking to the fields, because some of the ministers and the bishops would not let them into the pulpits to preach the fullness of the gospel. And regeneration and repentance and renewal was a big part of it. And that produced men like William Wilberforce,
mm-hmm.
and who was about the political, cultural reforms. And it wasn't just the one that he's most remembered for, which is, of course, the abolition of the slave trade, but it was also what he called essentially the recovery of morals, right, for Britain. What would it mean to have a reformation of morals? And so there were various instruments of government to suppress vice. Wilberforce talked about the fact that if you can culturally suppress the small things that are considered the smaller vices, you naturally would deal with the bigger ones. And that, he realized, took education.
Mm.
And so there was a big educational movement at that time. And by the time Queen Victoria is a child and she's being prepared for the throne, she's got an evangelical chaplain. So, and yet at that point, only a relatively small percentage of the Anglican clergy were truly evangelical.
Mm.
So it was, you see there, I think, a both and. Now, I'm not trying to suggest that the 18th century was analogous to our situation insofar as it was a still more Christianized culture from the plausibility structure point of view than our own.
Right.
But I think there may be a lesson there in this, John Wesley's last letter, the very last letter he ever wrote, was to William Wilberforce.
Hmm.
It was a letter of encouragement, and it was telling him that, you know, if God be for you, who can be against you? But men and devils are going to wear you out if this isn't the work of God.
Hmm.
Wesley understood, certainly, as did Whitefield, the importance of this, of regeneration, the power of the Holy Spirit, to even get these cultural, political tasks actually done. So I think, of course, it's a both and. Where are things going to go now if we're asking ourselves as we look at scripture and history, You know, how do we prophesy into this situation? I do think we're getting pushing towards a point where it's Christ or chaos, where we are increasingly seeing the radical decay of our. Of course, in Britain, there's the threat of Islam too, as you well know, because of the sheer numbers of Muslims in the country and their aspirations and their goals for European society. The question is, are we going to see a turning back towards Christ, or are we going to see a further falling off? And I think the only way to, what will determine that question in the sovereignty of God, of course, is how the Christian church responds now, how Christians respond in these next couple of decades to what is taking place. If there is a continued retrenchment in pietism, in retreatism, in escapism, in creating two kingdoms doctrines of radical separation of this age or the age to come or of nature and grace, then I don't see anything but a falling away of our cultures into complete decadence, and then it will be a missionary effort from the global south to try and recover our nations for the gospel in the future. But if the church now can get a hold of a transformationless vision of the gospel, rooted in the transformation of the regeneration of the heart to touch every single area of life, you don't need a massive majority to change a culture. We know this from looking at the radical woke queer movement. Tiny, tiny percentage of radicals, radical intellectuals, getting into, largely from the Frankfurt School, of course, getting into US universities, spreading their poison. Of course, there was a similar movement coming out of the French Revolution, and we've been living in the wake of that ever since. But that radical movement, you know, pre-World War II, that then exported itself to the West, tiny numbers of people radically changing the culture. 120 in the upper room filled with the Holy Spirit. And so I think there, it's hard. I struggle with sometimes flip-flopping between hope and despair this one.
Yes.
And so it is hard to live in that middle space of, well, we can only be faithful in our time and generation, and God is able to do the miracles that that we perhaps can't even imagine right now in our cultural moment.
I just kicked the camera down there. That's the challenge for me, is holding together the promised hope together with the reality that there are some real deep valleys that we've already gone through in the past and could be facing another situation where we'll be looking at that again. If that's God's will, then our role is to be faithful in wherever we're placed. But you said something there, and this wasn't what I was thinking about talking about, but I really wonder what happened in the UK and Europe as a whole because of the horrific loss of life and death in World War One and Two. World War One was just a slaughter pen. The numbers were astonishing for 10 yards worth of land. And then you had the bombing in World War Two and in Germany. We think about the bombing in England, yes, but by the time the end of the war, it was the Allies that were taking out entire cities.
Dresden.
Dresden did not have to happen. I think we can honestly say that was just completely inappropriate and wrong. And it just seems to me like there was a fundamental cultural change after, because it was two wars, but they were so close together. And so they impacted two generations massively. But it just seems like the 60s and the rebellion and the collapse of ethics and morality and a recognition of the worth of life, that's the generation coming after, the ones that experienced the horrors of the war. And I think it happened more slowly here because the war didn't happen here. There were no buildings. It all took place over here, and we lost a lot of people, but in comparison to the UK or Germany or something, it was infinitesimal. It just seems like wars like that, if they're undertaken on cultural, there was so many, when the guys jumped off those boats at Normandy, mm-hmm. there was still the impetus, the momentum of a Christian culture mm-hmm. and self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
And these people we're fighting are evil, and mm-hmm. and so we're doing it for this reason. That's gone.
Yeah.
And so it just seems like there was a massive change as the result of this huge loss of life. And maybe the church just didn't address it. Maybe the church just didn't see it coming. But I feel like we're still dealing with the mm-hmm. results of all of that, and have just never really realized how much changed when all those men did not come back, or, as we know now, many of them that did mm-hmm. came back so damaged and so destroyed internally, and we just told people to get over it, get back to doing what you were doing. And it just makes me wonder a little bit if in hindsight we could have done something a whole lot better, and if that did not hasten the abandonment of mm-hmm. any type of commitment to the Christian faith and to the idea of God and purpose and things that made such a difference in the past in Western culture.
I'm sure that's right. I mean, I don't think you can look at those two conflagrations, the worst in all of human history
so far
and not imagine that they wouldn't have a radical impact culturally. Mm-hmm. We have to, of course, see an element of the judgment of God mm-hmm. On Western culture in those two great wars. Churchill called World War II, of course, the fight for the survival of Christian civilization. So you're right, when those men were landing on the beaches and whatever arenas of war they were in World War II, they saw themselves as fighting for something that really mattered, fundamentally religiously, mm-hmm. That it was a fight for the survival of civilization itself, of Christian civilization mm-hmm. itself. And of course, after the war, Churchill is stunned by the fact that he's thrown out of office, mm-hmm. Having delivered victory and the people vote for socialism. And so there's some other factors here, and you know this history better than me, but by the end of the 19th century, you've got these philosophies and theologies developing of progress, of utopian, basically, philosophies mm-hmm. at the end of the 19th century that really see man on this inexorable upward curve. And Marxism has this inbuilt notion of progress and utopia. And what you're seeing is the secularization of postmillennialism.
Right.
You're seeing the secularization of, they think that they can deracinate, they can strip a Christian eschatology of the Christ and the kingdom of God
and a Christian anthropology right.
and build the kingdom of man, and you can retain that. It was liberalism's essence, wasn't it? You can retain the morals, you can retain the virtues, but you don't need the Christ of scripture. And this was already happening in the churches, and it was happening at the end of the 19th century. It was making deep inroads mm-hmm. and I think then that with the wars and then the men going away, and I think you make a very important point there, that this loss of the men, of fathers, mm-hmm. and the ones that did come back are so broken. I remember my own grandfather, radically damaged and broken by mm-hmm. the war, post-traumatic stress, and they didn't fully even understand that.
Shell-shocked.
He was so incapacitated emotionally and mentally until actually later his conversion, but even then, you know, the damage was there by the war, that he wasn't able to raise his four sons and daughter in the way that he would have wanted. Mm-hmm. And that damage gets passed down to the next generation. And I don't know whether you remember Mary Aberstadt's book, How the West Really Lost God.
Mm-mm.
And she talks about sociologically, we usually make the assumption that people stop believing in God and then they stop believing in the family. and the family collapses. So you stop believing in God, the family collapses. She says that's only half true when you study it sociologically. As family collapses, as fatherhood and family mm-hmm. ebbs away, people stop believing in God the Father. And so I found that a very interesting book. She talks about this reciprocal relation between collapse of the family and then collapse of belief. And so I think that it's interesting that with those wars and the steady, because what followed, as you said, was, you know, in the 60s, was the radical destruction of the normative structure of the family and sexual ethics.
Morals.
And morals. Well, it, from a fatherless generation, they called my grandparents' generation in England the silent generation. The silent generation who didn't pass on the values of that older world to the next generation. And so,
partly because you may have lost faith in them. You'd seen such terrible, horrible things.
Exactly.
That, why bother? Yeah.
Precisely. And I think that that following that, as then the family starts to collapse, and the men started emptying out of the churches, that was followed by the women in, you know, the decades that followed, but the men left first. And then you start getting this radical process of de-Christianization. So I think these false secular eschatologies that were all about the Parliament of Man and his inconquerable greatness in taking over all of history and bending it and the universe itself to his will. And then he's hit with two world wars.
Shows his own failure at doing all of that.
Shows the absolute failure of the liberalism that had made such inroads into the churches too. And then, because that was already sown, that was already there. I mean, one of my ancestors was involved in the formation of the United Church of Canada, which was a merger of the Methodists and the Presbyterians in 1925. It became the largest Protestant denomination in Canada. 20 years later, 35 years later, the denomination is being decimated. And today, the United Church of Canada is a real estate board. All they do is sell property. I mean, I'm exaggerating the point. I mean, they still call themselves a church, but all they're doing is selling off all the buildings that they can't put people in anymore.
Right.
So I think it's a combination of those factors, and I do think that those terrible wars played a part in that. But I ask myself, when you look at conflict now in Europe with Russia and Ukraine and the immediate threat to the United Kingdom and all of that, would my generation and would the generation under me go to war in terms of justice and truth and the whole idea of Christian civilization and righteousness? I don't think the courage is there. I don't think the belief is there. The
belief isn't there. No. The words of Churchill would ring very hollow.
Yeah.
There's no. The lexicon has been changed.
That's right.
The lexicon has been changed completely, and that's why I look at our situation, and I understand what people are saying. People are saying we need to tell the world this is where, if you're tired of the chaos. Now, I don't know if you've seen these, but there's these LED strips. They're made up of LED lights, so you can put a message across them. And I've got one in the back of my truck and one in the back of my RV. And the one in the back of the RV, I can run while I'm driving. So I have Acts 17:31 about the coming judgment.
Mm-hmm.
That's scrolling across the back while I'm driving. I'm eventually going to get shot or run off the road or something, I would assume. but in my truck, I have a briefer message that says, it's Christ or chaos, and personally, I'm tired of the chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to remember I have it running, because you have people pull up next to you, and they'll pull into your blind spot, and then they're just sitting there, and I'm like, what are you doing? Well, they're reading my message, and I keep forgetting about it. And then they're pulling up and going, like this, you know. And I'm at first I'm like, what? And then, oh, yeah, hey, cool, yeah. And I just have to keep in mind that I've got the thing going. But it's true. It's Christ or chaos, and I'm tired of the chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this chaos happening around us right now. And look, people are looking to us who have a voice,
yeah,
to give direction in a pretty unique situation. I know the scripture says there's nothing new under the sun. That doesn't mean that there aren't new conjugations of evils and things. I've often said, from my perspective, it seems to me that the greatest evil that has ever stood up on planet Earth is secularism, because it is the exact negation of everything that Christ teaches is good. Mm-hmm. There's no purpose, there's no judgment, there's no meaning. All these things is what secularism is saying. And so if Christ's enemies need to be put under his feet, mm-hmm. something's going to happen that is going to do that to secularism. Now, you were saying earlier, you know, we're seeing it coming apart at the seams. Part of me is concerned, because I have to wonder if that isn't exactly what they want, mm-hmm. to create such a position of chaos that once people are in chaos, they're willing to say, look, we just want order, no matter what that order is.
Authoritarian order.
An authoritarian, totalitarian order. And they'd be willing to accept that. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, as soon as that comes in, they're not going to be doing that on the basis of transgender rights or anything mm-hmm. else. They're going to get rid of all that stuff. But they're also going to establish, it would seem to me, a very anti-Christian attitude in the process, because you can't have totalitarianism when you have
the principle of freedom.
Principle of freedom that comes from the risen Christ. So, as people are looking to Christian leaders, the past few years have demonstrated that up until this point, outside of a few weirdos at Frankie Schaefer's house, and at Rush Dooney's house, and maybe they ran into each other once in a while or something, we were quite happy to just get along.
Yeah.
And didn't put a whole lot of thought into all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, you had the mission of God before COVID and stuff like that, and you obviously addressed a number of things there, though clearly even you would probably go, I'd want to add this, 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 and this mm-hmm. to what I wrote back then, now in light of what we've experienced, and sort of Ruler of Kings sort of adds that aspect of it for you. I'm speaking of Dr. Booth's books here. But I'm feeling a lot of weight as a Christian leader, because these are very weighty questions, and they're coming from a position of, I've never experienced this stuff.
Yeah.
This is new territory. And people keep asking, well, you teach church history, so how did people handle this in the past? And I go, well, they didn't. No. That's the problem. That we've never been in a situation where you literally have the ability on the part of governmental agencies to track every person's movements. They know exactly where they are. They know, and pretty soon to even control their speech, what can and cannot be heard. It's really, really hard to look in history and go, oh yeah, they handled like this in the past, because we've never faced it before.
No.
And so we're all having to think through a lot of stuff. We really, really are. And obviously, you all up there in Canada, I think we're put into a pressure cooker that we didn't, like here in Arizona, most churches did close down. Apologia didn't. We were one of only, how many do you think there were?
Two or three
in the valley that didn't. And so we still had a fair amount of freedom, and that magnified our voice because people were then looking at, well, here's the churches that didn't shut down, so let's listen to what they have to say. But you guys were up there in the pressure cooker. You were facing the imminent possibility of law enforcement officials showing up at your front door.
Yeah.
I mean, you and your family undoubtedly talked about that, right?
Yep. Yep.
And so you wrote out of that context, and it makes a difference, doesn't it?
It does.
It talk to me a little bit about that. How did you feel that changed writing the book that John Cooper and I wrote endorsements for?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause when I listened to it, John was asking me all the same questions, and I'm like, so I think I wrote you and said, hey, can I slip a free publication copy to John? And yeah, go ahead. So how did that pressure cooker change your writing process and what you feel you need to address?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that Mission of God was theoretical, purely, because we were seeing all of the early signs of this, and I was feeling in Canada at the time, even though I was being called a hysteric and all this sort of stuff back in 2014. As a pastoring a church, as I was at that time as well in downtown Toronto, I could see the questions changing. I could see what was things shifting and changing in the culture, and the voices that I thought really mattered from the past were just not being heard, and there was no interest in hearing them. But with Ruler of Kings, we had, and I was experienced the immediacy of my own ministry being effectively shut down. We weren't technically allowed to be running programs for the Institute. Fortunately, we had access to a farm property at the time, and so we were farming during our programs. But we had my own church on one day had an invasion of the police into the church building, and I did have conversations with my wife about what's the plan if and when they come to arrest me and so on. And there were, of course, several pastors in Canada that actually did happen to.
Right.
So for me, I guess there was a greater sense of urgency to the writing.
Does it clarify theology?
It certainly does.
It sort of cuts away some of the excess there.
And you're less concerned. You're definitely less concerned about being sort of seen to be measured. Or, I mean, I had a chapter called "The Cult of the Expert" in there.
Right, right.
And I wasn't being concerned about trying to maintain some sort of academic distance in the writing. It was becoming so clear, and yet we were in and remain in a tiny minority in the Canadian landscape, and the major movements and the major evangelical movements basically took a public stance against open churches.
Right, right.
And I have been circling the wagons for the most part ever since, despite the fallout being so obvious or undeniable. I mean, there's all kinds of talk now about Canada pioneering its ID system. I was even hearing from political figures last week that mask mandates might be returning to Ontario and this kind of thing. And so I think one of the key differences is that this is sort of an added element in Ruler of Kings as well. And you talked about it. I mean, a number of years, decades ago, actually, a book by an obscure Dutch thinker called Van Riesen, he wrote a book called The Society of the Future. And he talks in there about the inescapable direction of Western culture with the abandonment of the principles of sphere sovereignty being totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. That was 40 or 50 years ago he was writing about this. And so the mask got torn off during those last two or three years of what was already going on behind the scenes. And I was kind of talking about a mission of God. But during that period, the mask gets ripped off and you see this technocratic, scientific socialist order that is wanting to impose itself on society. And as people saw up in Canada, you know, the federal government seizing people's assets,
right.
Riding people down with horses who were holding candy floss and and having a street party, the Freedom Convoy and all of that, the extent to which the state was ready to go, tossing pastors into jail. Most Christians couldn't have even have imagined that even 10 years ago, they'd have thought you would be losing it. So I think it did help me, it crystallized. There is a certain, in Ruler of Kings, there is a certain development of thought, especially in this area of the nature of a Christian political thought that crystallizes for me in Ruler of Kings, and will continue to do so, I trust, as I continue to learn and develop.
I am absolutely convinced that we are simply in a hiatus right now. They're retooling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Climate's the next big one.
Oh, it is. It is the mechanism they're going to use to continue to push for this ultimate technological totalitarian state, and something you touched on that almost no one touches on at all, the transhumanism. And the insertion of what we call medical devices, but really, you know, if you listen to Noah Yuval Harari, with the World Economic Forum, the next stages in human evolution are all going to be, you know, the digital interface between the brain and the internet and all the things that come along with that, and of course all the DNA and everything else that we're doing. If these advances were taking place within the context of a Christian worldview, that's totally different than having these advances taking place within the context of secular humanism that has absolutely no place for the value of individual human life. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm looking at this situation and going, there's going to be more clarification coming, and sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
We've got a little bit of a vacation here, but what do we do with this time? Mm-hmm. What do we do with this time? Mm-hmm. Now, I know we'll wrap up here in a moment, but Ezra Institute is seeking to impact the next generation, seeking to encourage young leaders. We need people who have, well, let's just face it, Joe, you're younger than I am.
A little bit.
But we're
quite a bit.
We ain't. Yeah. Okay. Keep going.
A lot.
Yes. Okay. You can stop there now. Thank you very much. But still, the fact of the matter is, we need the younger people who have the energy and the drive, and we have to be sowing into, investing into the next generations, especially if we are going to be facing this kind of tremendously difficult time. It's they and their children and their grandchildren that need to have a foundation that's going to last and give them that place to rebuild. Mm-hmm. Because a society that can't tell the difference between a boy and a girl is not going to last forever.
Yeah.
And a society that is built upon technological tyranny also cannot last. It does scare me because I have grandchildren. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to go through this. But if they're going to, then I have to do everything I can to give them the foundation to be able to do so.
Yeah.
And it has to be a positive foundation, not a fearful foundation, not a we're giving up and, you know, don't polish the brass on a sinking ship type stuff. But it also has to be realistic in that we could go through some really challenging times. And so you have your institutes that you have in various locations. In hindsight, in 2019, when Jeff and Luke came up, and they said, you ought to come along. That would have been my one shot to get across the border and to get back again in one piece.
Well, we're coming to America for you, so you can come. You can turn up in your van.
That's true, but you're going to California, right?
Florida first.
Okay, all right. Well, Florida's free, so we're good. We're good on Florida for now. I'd avoid California if I were you. Anyway, sorry, Californians. Nothing personal there, but I like freedom. So you're working to do that kind of investment into the next generation, and that's what the Ezra Institute's about. And so we want to encourage you to continue to do that and get the word out through this, and encourage people along those lines and challenge them as well. And so you're going to be speaking, I think, tomorrow here.
Yep.
What are you going to be speaking about?
So while they gave me the broad subject of Ruler of Kings.
Well, I wonder where they came up with that title. I don't know.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about the the fact that there is a third alternative to, we tend to think, Christians tend to think that we're either faced with this choice of a return to a unified ecclesiastical culture, like that of the medieval world, mm-hmm. and then sort of the Constantinian boogeyman idea, mm-hmm. or we have to accept secularism,
right.
and those are the two choices. And I'm going to be saying, well, actually, no, that's not
Christian libertarianism.
That's right.
That's right.
There is actually a third mm-hmm. option here that hasn't perhaps fully been tried
right.
Historically. And I think you made a very important point in saying that, you know, we're, as Christians, we're not opposed to cultural work. We're not opposed to technology,
right?
And putting human thought, human creativity, the making of tools and so on to use for the glory of God. The issue comes when if the sciences, in the broadest sense, human knowledge, are used to try, instead of tracing out God's norms and laws. Mm-hmm. are used to try and control and reorder society. Right. The first casualty is human freedom. The human person is liquidated because freedom is liquidated in a technocratic social order. What we want is a Christian order where we're putting all of our efforts, all of our powers, all of our gifts, all of our humanity towards the glory of God and His kingdom and His order. And that brings liberty. So it's an order of tyranny or liberty, slavery or freedom. And so in my session tomorrow, I'm going to be just trying to give people an understanding of these, how these two primary ideas have diverged and how there is actually a third possibility that we can, in obedience, live under the Lordship of Christ and apply in all of our cultural work and efforts, including the areas of technology, and serve the Lord faithfully. So how do we avoid falling foul of that false dichotomy, basically?
I think it'd be very, very helpful, because a lot of people, they hear the standard objections, and they're always based upon what was done in the past and
yeah.
and that kind of thing. And the chapter that I listened to multiple times to try to get hold of, and you might find this interesting, I think it was because of my eschatological past and how I was raised, was I think it was the last or almost one of the last chapters on the distinction between the church and the kingdom.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that tomorrow.
That was incredibly helpful, because if you were raised in a dispensational fundamentalist background,
yeah.
you have to read that one three or four times to go, okay, you know, because it's yeah. such a shift.
Yeah.
From where you were to where you need to be to understand
yeah.
how to make application of these things. So I bought a half case myself when it came out. So,
thank you, James.
So most people don't do that, but I did. And
can you buy a few more skids to get me on the New York Times bestseller list?
Well, no.
In a warehouse somewhere.
Yeah. We've heard of some people to do that. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
No, okay.
No, yeah,
apology is not the budget, surely.
Don't think so. Jeff, we got the budget for that. I don't see Jeff around here anyways. He's hiding. So I do highly recommend it. In fact, a friend of mine has a webcast up in Las Vegas, not Las Vegas, Nevada area, and I just thought he needed some encouragement, so I sent him a copy of to Amazon. So it was another sale for you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Of the book, and I keep telling people, okay, get ready to be challenged. It's not going to be an easy read, not in the sense of difficult language, but I mean, you are British, so I mean, there is that, and I think you misspell honor and labor and all sorts of extra U's you don't really need anywhere. It could be a much shorter book without all the extra
not
U's.
Not big sins, though, are they?
Yeah, no. But anyways, I sent that up to him, and he said he's going to get to it. So we keep trying our best to get that out there.
Well,
so,
we do have it here.
Oh, good.
Just so people know, so all of my books, none of it comes to me. It all funds the Ezra Institute. So when you buy a copy of Mission of God or Ruler of Kings, it's all helping the Institute put on programs and advance our work. So we're just opening a new office in Tennessee in the USA, and we're going to be starting to offer training in the USA very soon. And
well, that means I can put Chattanooga on my on my route list.
Absolutely, put us on the list.
Yeah. So, and I hope things are getting better, because, you know, a few years ago, things were so bad that you invited me to be one of your fellows. So I'm hoping that things have picked up since then.
Well, at least if we start doing stuff in the U.S., you can actually come and speak.
I can actually do something.
And be a proper fellow for
that's
us.
Rather than on
online.
The internet, which for some reason the net never liked me being on with you guys.
It's not as incarnational, let's face it.
That's true. Well, thank you, sir,
thank you, James.
for joining us. And there you go, Seth. Pretty good close on that. And we finally ended up with a studio audience because you were all in there watching a session, which wasn't supposed to be going on right now anyways. So there you go. But thanks for showing up for the Dividing Line, and we'll see you next time. God bless.